Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Gender, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Anya Jabur, Regents Professor of History at the University of Montana and author of Sofa Nisba Breckenridge, Championing Women's Activism in Modern America from the University of Illinois Press. Welcome, Anya.
Thank you so much, Christina.
Would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I grew up largely in the South, but also in the West, which is where I now live and teach at the University of Montana. And perhaps because of my early experiences growing up in the South, I have dedicated most of my professional career to researching women, families, and children in the American South. But for my current book, I ended up starting with somebody who began her life in the South and then moved on and lived her entire adult life in the North. And at the same time, because she began her life in the 19th century, which was really my original area of focus, she then had the audacity to live until 1948. So in the course of tracing her life, I found myself having to move both geographically and chronologically, and greatly expand my base of knowledge about American history, which was great. It was kind of like being in graduate school all over again.
And can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write this particular book? What drew you to this?
Absolutely. So I had written previously about children's experiences in the South, and in particular, the experiences of young white women who attended boarding schools and early colleges in the South. And I had originally thought that I would work on kind of a companion piece to one of my previous books called Scarlet Sisters, that I conceived of in my mind as my Southern schoolmarm book. So my idea was that since I'd been researching the students' point of view, I would turn the tables and I would research the teachers' point of view. In the course of doing the kind of initial legwork to identify potential collections and individuals and schools that I might want to follow up on, I stumbled across this person, Sofa Nisba Breckenridge, who was indeed a school teacher in the 19th century South, so that she fell within the parameters of my planned study. But then it turned out that she was so much more. So it turned out that she was this remarkable woman, one of the first women in the United States to earn advanced degrees, both an MA and a PhD in political science and political economy, and then went on also to become one of the first women in the United States to earn her Juris Doctorate. And then, after all of that, it turned out she was unable to get a faculty position in any of her several areas of expertise. And instead, initially, she took a position teaching what was arguably the first women's studies course in the U.S. in 1905. And she did it in a department that at the time I began my research, I would not have thought would have lent itself to this, which was a Department of Household Administration. And so this is sort of where it all began, is that I was just amazed by this woman and really struck by how much education she had and yet how much discrimination she confronted. But then I was also really interested in what she did with that, and that because she could not achieve success as a faculty member in any of her areas of expertise as they were defined then, because the fields of political science and political economy and law were also male dominated, that she then took the expertise and the training and the social statistic techniques that she'd learned in graduate school and basically created a new profession out of whole cloth, what I call in the book a female-friendly profession, so that she could use all of that knowledge that she had gained in a field that would actually welcome women and indeed be particularly responsive to the needs of women, both as practitioners and as clients.
In the opening to the book, you talk about the tremendous job of actually tracking down all of the documents and researching her and putting together the full breadth of her life. And as you go through the book, the question keeps popping up for the readers, why has her story been missing from every women's history book, from every U.S. history book? And it seems like that became one of your driving questions too. And can you share with us why you feel her story was missing?
Sure. Yeah, so this was definitely one of the questions that was like a nagging question that became sort of a mission for me to figure out, you know, how in the world could this woman who achieved so much and was so important in such a broad array of social reforms and social movements be largely neglected by scholars? And I mean, to the extent that, you know, I every time I got a book on progressive or New Deal era reforms, I checked the index to see if she's in there. And not only was she usually missing, but when she was there, her name was frequently misspelled. So this was definitely something that I was really, really curious about. And I came up eventually with a variety of theories for why she might have been forgotten, one of which is that she simply did not fit neatly into any category. I mean, the fact that she did so much in some ways worked against her, because you can't just have her in a book on woman suffrage or a book on the progressive era or a book on the New Deal, because she fits into all those categories, but she also fits into so many other categories, right? Into works on pacifism, into works on immigrant welfare, into works on social work, which social work, to be fair, tended to be where she got the most attention. And so I think that in a way, part of the reason that she has been overlooked is because she engaged in such wide-ranging reforms. And ultimately, I came to see that as being one of the wonderful things about this project, is that she was involved in such a wide range of reforms. And so I could use her life as a window onto this whole world of women's activism from the progressive era through the New Deal. And I could also, using her life as a sort of a vehicle, cover such a wide range and address such a wide range of issues that I would not have been able to do with, say, a less complicated character. At the same time, what that meant is that the research process was sometimes a little bit daunting. Her own papers are quite extensive. Her papers at the Library of Congress alone take up 37 reels of microfilm, which is how I did that part of the research, because I am in Montana. So I would order them four reels at a time and go through them. And I did that first to get a sense of the basic chronology of her life, those those records are chronologically organized, and to kind of get a sense of all the different things that she was involved in. And, you know, kept making notes along the way going, oh my gosh, she was involved in this too. And she was involved in this too. And it was really fun and exciting because at the time I started this project, I'd been teaching U.S. women's history for 15 years. I've now been teaching U.S. women's history for 25 years. And I kept finding examples of her being involved in reforms that I'd been teaching about, but based, you know, largely on my reading and secondary sources. And so it was really exciting to get primary source material on all of those things. And then she also was involved in all of these things that, despite having taught U.S. women's history for 15 or, you know, 20 years, depending on where I was in the research process, that I was completely unfamiliar with. So for instance, before I began this project, I had no idea that there was such a thing as Pan-American feminism. I had never, you know, heard or read anything about that. So that was really exciting. And it also meant that, as I said before, I had to do a tremendous amount of background reading in areas that I had relatively shallow, I guess, knowledge in before. But it also meant that I had to do a whole lot of additional research in the primary sources. So in addition to obviously reading all of Breckinridge's own papers, not only at the Library of Congress, but also at several other repositories, I felt it was necessary as well to look at the records of the many, many, many organizations in which she was active and played a key role. And I also really wanted to get perspectives on her outside of her own perspective and her professional organizational commitments. So I also looked for records and letters of people who had known her as people who had been her students, people who had been her colleagues, and even people who had been her enemies. So Dora Stevens of the National Woman's Party was, in some sense, Breckinridge's arch enemy. And so one of the last things I did in terms of the research was to look at Dora Stevens' papers and see what she had to say about Breckinridge. It was not complimentary. To be fair, Breckinridge also was not complimentary about Dora Stevens. It was a mutual animosity.
The book really is, in many ways, a who's who of women's history. As you go through, there's so many people that she encounters, that she spends time with, that I had no idea that she knew, because I, like many people, wasn't very familiar with all of her roles in so many things that your book talks about. But I was wondering if we could really talk about her, where she was born and when she was born, because as you go through her life and you share about her, those early things really had a huge impact on her, specifically when she was born and what was going on in the nation at that time. Could you share a bit about that impact? We'll tell listeners what that is and what that impact was on her.
Sure. Yes. So, Brecken, I mean, you're right. The time and place here were interesting. I mean, of course, that's always interesting to historians. But so Breckinridge was born in Kentucky right after the Civil War in 1866. Her father, who had been an officer in the Confederate Army, dubbed her his peace baby. And that was a moniker that would come to have a lot of meaning in her later life, since she became a lifelong pacifist. And what that timing meant was that she was growing up in the South during Reconstruction, in the immediate aftermath of emancipation, and also during Redemption, the process by which white male Southerners reclaimed their political and economic dominance. And her father was very much a part of that as a U.S. congressman representing Kentucky. So those things had a really profound effect on Breckinridge, not necessarily in the ways that one might have expected. So because Breckinridge herself came from a slaveholding family, her family, of course, had financial losses as a result of African-American emancipation. And while some white Southerners responded to that with resentment, to put it mildly, directed at newly freed Southern Blacks, Breckinridge instead took it to mean that people often suffered financial reverses for reasons that were beyond their control. And thus, she dedicated her adult life to trying to create programs that would provide a safety net for people during financial hardship. Not necessarily what you would expect, but that's where she took it. And then likewise, in growing up in the Redemption era, I mean, her teen years coincided with a terrible period of racial violence, a period that some historians call the nadir of Southern race relations. And her own father participated in the disfranchisement of African Americans. He actually came up with Kentucky's version of the poll tax, and he defended Klansmen who had been, he was a lawyer, he defended Klansmen who had been accused of assailing African-American citizens. But again, what Breckinridge took from that was not that. What she took instead from that was that at the same time he did those things, he also said that African-Americans were entitled to fair treatment, and that that meant that because they paid taxes, they should also get their own schools, and that because they were subject to the law, they should be allowed to testify in court on their own behalf. And so Breckinridge, in her memoirs, makes this sort of very selective use of her father's political participation to emphasize the ways that he stood for what she calls fair play, rather than emphasizing the ways in which he actually stood for white supremacy.
And a lot of those conflicts come to the forefront for her personally when her beliefs are really put into challenge, when she's at Wellesley and she has to serve students in the dining hall that she was really unprepared to be asked to do. Can you tell that really powerful, important story?
Absolutely. So Breckinridge really never examined, I think, her beliefs about race until she went to Wellesley. And while there's no evidence, direct evidence anyway, that as a child, Breckinridge was aware of racial violence, although it's hard to imagine that she wasn't. But it is quite clear, not so much from her own writings, but from those of her older sister, Ella, that the Breckinridge family definitely practiced what Jennifer Ritterhouse calls racial etiquette, and that they abided by this kind of code that reinforced white supremacy and demanded Black deference. And one of the most important parts of that racial etiquette was that Blacks and whites never ate meals together. Blacks served whites in the formal areas of the house, the dining room and the parlor, and they ate after whites and separately in the kitchen or the cellar. And that was one of the sort of really most enshrined pieces of this racial etiquette that helped to separate the races and reinforce white dominance. So when Breckinridge went to Wellesley, then this was challenged because Wellesley was one of the only colleges to admit Black students on an equal basis with whites. Not that it admitted very many, but it did have some. And also the president of Wellesley was insistent, was an avid supporter of African-American rights. And Breckinridge's father grumbled about her being an abolitionist, in fact. Anyway, and so African-American groups would come to campus, choirs and the like. Frederick Douglass came and spoke on campus as well. And that was really hard for Breckinridge at the time. I think it was probably the first time in her entire life she had heard about slavery from the standpoint of a former slave. And she was really profoundly affected by that. But the incident that you're referring to is when an African-American college choir came to campus, and then they stayed for dinner. And at Wellesley, they had, you know, long dining tables, and everyone sat together, and nobody served you. It was family style. You passed the plates, you know, from one to the other. And so Breckinridge was, you know, very eager to emulate Alice Palmer, the Freeman, actually, at the time, the president of the college. And she also had never confronted this experience, this situation in her entire life. And she describes it in her memoirs as being this kind of really difficult moment. She said that she served the African-American women at her table, but that she herself could not swallow her own food. She just couldn't do it. But she moved past that. She overcame that. And by the time she graduated, she had actually participated in a conversation that ended up desegregating the college's big social event of the year. And she did that on behalf of a classmate, an African-American classmate. Her name was Ella Smith. And Ella was like Nisba, to use both women's first names, a classics scholar. And so they had that in common. And it's really interesting because when Nisba Breckinridge first enrolled at Wellesley, she encountered Ella Smith. And she encountered another one of those rules of racial etiquette, which is that a white person never uses a title to refer to a black person, whereas black people always were expected to use titles to refer to white people. And so in her one of her early letters home, she refers to Ella Smith as Miss Smith, but she puts Miss in quote marks, indicating that she was really uncomfortable with using that title. But then, of course, she also mentioned that she was very, you know, apparently quite intellectually able. And then ultimately, she ends up advocating on Ella Smith's behalf that Miss Smith, and now she really meant Miss Smith, she didn't have to put those uncomfortable quote marks around the name, that Miss Smith's family and friends should be able to attend this event just like all of the other students. So Wellesley for Breckinridge was a really important set of experiences between her Kentucky childhood and then her adult life as an educator and an activist in Chicago, without which she might not have become an advocate for racial equality and African-American welfare, along with all of her other activist commitments.
And there's a really strong theme through the book about how, while she's growing as an intellectual, she's also unraveling so many of the beliefs that she thought she knew, often unintentionally, because she finds out that while she was so close to her dad and he had been such a strong relationship in her life, he was the one who believed in her intellectually and encouraged her so much. After she graduates college, she finds out that her dad has betrayed her mother in a really significant way. Can you talk about her dad's, what I will call her dad's sex scandal?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. And it was one of the greatest sex scandals of the age. And for Nisba, it was absolutely devastating. So, I mean, Breckinridge's after college experience was hard enough. She had very lofty ideals and high goals for what she would do after college. And then, like a lot of other women of her generation, she kind of came down to earth with a thump when she realized that many of the avenues were blocked by gender discrimination and also, just as importantly, by what Jane Addams famously called the family claim, this expectation that unmarried women would devote themselves to taking care of their families rather than pursuing their own goals. So that would have been hard enough. But for Breckinridge, yeah, I mean, it was made immeasurably worse by, first of all, her mother's untimely death, and then immediately on the heels of that, well, almost immediately, within a year, her father's remarriage, which then provoked his longtime mistress to file charges against him. And those charges and her evidence quite indisputably showed that they had been carrying on a long-term affair. It had actually begun when Nisba was in her first year at Wellesley, and when the woman herself was within a year of Nisba's own age, which is, must have been terrible, although Breckinridge never commented on that in her memoirs. It's one of the interesting silences there. Anyway, and so, yeah, I mean, Nisba had adored her father. She said she learned her letters from his law books. He had been the one who encouraged her to pursue higher education. He'd basically strong-armed the University of Kentucky into letting women in so that she could become educated. And then he supported her at Wellesley. And learning that her father, who she had trusted so implicitly, had betrayed her mother so completely was really very difficult. And then, to make matters worse, he actually recruited his children to collect what he thought would be exculpatory evidence. And so poor Nisba, who at this point was trying to start a law practice, ended up spending her first year as a lawyer interviewing people, trying to cast reasonable doubt on Madeline Pollard. That's the name of the woman who'd had this long-term affair, trying to cast doubt on Madeline Pollard's claims that that she had had two living children with Breckinridge's father, WCP, and had miscarried a third. And so Breckinridge got to interview chambermaids and at the, you know, houses of assignation where WCP and Pollard had carried on their affair, and interview the personnel at the orphanage where the children that resulted from that affair were placed. And again, she does not talk very much about that in her memoir. She kind of compresses this time period in her memoirs and brushes over it really quickly and just sort of says, it was a difficult time and I became very ill. And then, you know, moves us right along to Chicago, where she sort of worked out her own salvation by pursuing higher education. But it's clear that, I mean, this was a shattering experience. And although it was personally devastating, I also think it is probably the case that she might never have left home and then might never have achieved the things that she achieved had it not been for this betrayal, because it's shortly after that terrible time in her life that she went to Chicago, and she then claimed, and whether this is accurate or not, it was certainly an emotional truth. She claimed that she never afterwards went back to Kentucky without having a return ticket to Chicago in her possession.
Wow. So I want to continue with the story of Chicago. And you open chapter 4 with a riot. And people will be listening to this at different points in their life. But as we're recording it, we are in the midst of tremendous protests and riots. So it was striking at so many points in this book how many things she experienced are happening right now, including when her dad was accused by the woman. He said she had been a 17-year-old experienced temptress. And I couldn't help but think of some recent cases in the news where that has been the original defense an accused man has offered. And then as the information came out, you know, it unraveled that. So it was really surprised and not surprised that that's an age-old go-to defense. And then to go into the next chapter, and that we open with this vivid riot happening. So I wondered if you could take us to that.
Absolutely. Right before I go there, I'll just mention, this is not in the book. This is really an article that I wrote for the Journal of Women's History. But I think it's really significant that in the 1930s, so decades after the affair, Breckinridge then became a passionate advocate of civil rights for accused prostitutes. And in that fight, She also denounced the sexual double standard that held that women who had sex outside of marriage were ruined, and that men could, you know, carry on merrily with their lives. And again, this is one of these things that I'm inferring rather than something that she actually says, but I firmly believe there's a connection between her her sense that Madeleine Pollard had been wronged both by her father and by the you know, society and the legal system, and then her later defense of women accused of engaging in the sex trade, whether they did or didn't. But to your question, the riot. Yes. The riot that I write about in that chapter took place in 1915. And of course, it did not start as a riot. It started as an entirely peaceful protest of 1,500 women, men, and children who were protesting the widespread unemployment in Chicago. But the police overreacted, and they called in the riot squad, and they just attacked the protesters and injured many of them quite severely. And then where Breckinridge comes in is that she was there when the protest that ended with police violence occurred. And she then called Jane Addams, and the two of them went together to the precinct where some of the protesters had been jailed. And so they went there to bail them out. But also Breckinridge herself was asked to speak about whether or not the protesters were inciting a riot, which is what the police officers had claimed. And she defended them and said, no, they absolutely were not inciting a riot. They were engaged in peaceful protest. They were calling attention to the fact that, you know, labor is different from other resources. You can't just like hold it in reserve and then, you know, trickle it out later. People need to eat now, not later when jobs are available. And so she defended the protesters. And one of my favorite images of Breckinridge is from that moment when she was sitting, when a photographer took a picture of her, and she was in the police precinct, sitting very composed, very calm, very proper in a suit and gloves and hat, right? And she was there to bail out the jailed protesters, which I just thought really kind of captured a lot of things about her, that she understood and appreciated the need for on the ground protest. And she defended the rights of the protesters, and she upheld the legitimacy of their concerns. And at the same time, she herself was a very privileged, I mean, compared to the protesters, most of the protesters, you know, she was privileged, she was white, she was middle class, she was educated. And so although she did sometimes engage in street action, she, generally speaking, cast herself as what I call an academic activist or an activist academic. So she used her intellectual abilities and her academic acumen and her professional persona to promote public policy and to support social reform more behind the scenes rather than in the streets. Much as, you know, you don't have a picture of her in the protest, right? You have a picture of her later bailing out the people who had been jailed.
And there was another section of that chapter that struck me as being very timely. Again, we're taping during the COVID pandemic, and how strongly affected the meatpacking industry has been affected by that, and calls for reforms for worker safety to protect their health. And you also talk about how she was investigating the meatpacking industry. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So in 1906, shortly after Breckinridge had completed her formal education, she had become acquainted with Jane Addams and the whole circle of reformers, including labor reformers, who were affiliated with Hull House. And because Breckinridge was trained in social scientific methods, and because she was particularly interested in the problems of working women, Jane Addams suggested that she should conduct an inspection of the working conditions of women and girls in Chicago's meatpacking district. And Breckinridge agreed, and she spent several months there. And the situation that she encountered, as we probably all now know to expect, the situation was horrific, right? The workers worked in very crowded conditions and unventilated and terribly unsanitary working conditions for very long hours and for very little pay. It was just all around dreadful. And yes, when you read the accounts now of the kind of tight working conditions and the lack of concern for worker safety in today's meatpacking plants, I mean, it's just eerily reminiscent of what Breckinridge observed. And this was another one of those aha moments for Breckinridge. I think she'd had an intellectual understanding of the problem before, but she was really profoundly affected by what she saw. She told Addams that she could not sleep because she couldn't, you know, she closed her eyes and she kept seeing the workers from the plants. But of course, because this is how she kind of dealt with things, what she did with that angst was to try to change policy. So that she amassed evidence, and then she used about Chicago's plants, and then she used that evidence to lobby for a federal investigation. And then that federal investigation ultimately led to the establishment of two new bureaus in the Labor Department, the U.S. Children's Bureau and the U.S. Women's Bureau. And then those bureaus went on to lobby for new labor legislation for decades to come, which ultimately resulted in 1938 in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established a minimum wage and maximum hours for both women and men and outlawed child labor. However, unfortunately, it also excluded a number of occupations, especially occupations filled by people of color and women, like seasonal occupations and domestic occupations. And of course, we're still seeing the problems that omission created. Meanwhile, at a local level, Breckinridge became a leader in the fight for what people at the time called protective legislation or gender-specific legislation or age-specific legislation to ban child labor and to limit the hours of labor for women workers. And also, although she was less successful on this front, to promote a minimum wage for women workers in Illinois.
And as we go through the book, we really see her grappling with what is equality, what is fairness, what is feminism. And you quote her as saying, "Nothing can be more unequal than calling unequals equal." Can you tell us how that really sort of sums up this philosophy that she's building as she goes along?
Yes. So this is one of these places where Breckinridge takes her father's, you know, maxim about fair play to places that I'm sure he never envisioned. That Breckinridge was always interested in striking a balance between demanding equality and acknowledging difference. She believed that it was the government's job to recognize and to offset inequality, and thus make it possible by, you know, to recognize that there wasn't a level playing field, to make the playing field level so that then people could actually achieve their full potential. And so, I mean, you see this now, right? Sometimes on Facebook, you see those memes and there's a fence and there's a game or something going on beyond the fence. And then there's people behind the fence and, you know, there's a tall person and there's a short person and the short person is on a box. And the point is that, you know, if it's equal, the short person is not going to be able to see over the fence. But if there's this particular accommodation for the short person, then that's what makes them really equal, right? I mean, this is a meme that goes around. I mean, that was kind of Breckinridge's point, right? That that it was the government's job to take note of all kinds of structural inequalities that disadvantaged people, particularly socially and economically, and to mitigate and hopefully, you know, completely eliminate those inequalities so that then people could really be on an equal playing field. And so that's true, I think, for her, all of her domestic reform activity. Actually, I think it's true for her international reform activity as well. She would have said the same thing about developing nations. But to go back to the chapter that I really delve into this is an idea that really informed her approach to feminism. And in particular, the context of that quote that you shared was that she became one of the most outspoken opponents of the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1920s and 1930s, not because she was opposed to women's equality, but because she feared that an absolute equal, identical treatment under the law would actually exacerbate inequalities because it would not take into account women's disadvantages in the workforce. It would not take into account women's special responsibilities for domestic life. It would not take into account that women and only women bore children and cared for them in their youngest years. And that so her concern was that the Equal Rights Amendment would ruin all of the programs that Breckinridge and many of her like-minded activists had been working on for so long that did take those inequalities into account and try to address them. So things like protective legislation, which I've already talked about, but also programs like mothers' pensions, which was the kind of popular term for financial assistance for single mothers, and also programs like the one established by the Shepherd-Counter Act in the 1920s that provided federally subsidized health care for pregnant women and new mothers and their infants. And all of those programs, of course, were gender specific. And so Breckinridge feared that the Equal Rights Amendment would dismantle those programs. And I mean, this was a really realistic fear. I mean, these programs were under a lot of attack. This was the 1920s. It was the first Red Scare. A lot of people were not at all happy with the federal government helping anyone, much less women and children. The Supreme Court had struck down minimum wage for women workers in 1923, declaring that the 19th Amendment, the suffrage amendment, had made women equal, so they no longer were entitled to special treatment. The American Medical Association and other powerful lobbyists were fighting really hard to defund the maternity and infancy program established by the Shepherd-Counter Act. So Breckinridge was, in the sense, being quite realistic. And she said, you know, basically, you know, let's not sacrifice real women in the name of this ideal of equality. It's not equal if we actually treat everyone absolutely identically. We have to take difference into account.
And do you think some of her intense knowledge of how that feels really was rooted back in when she was highly capable and well prepared and yet had few choices of which colleges to go to?
That is a great question. And I would say yes. This is not in the book. but in her memoirs, she talks about how she designed this pioneering women's studies class that she taught. It was on the legal and economic status of women. And she talked about how she made sure to address the different but equally difficult circumstances that confronted women on sort of the ends of the spectrum of being disadvantaged versus privileged, right? That more disadvantaged women were cordoned off into poorly paid industries that had terrible working conditions, such as the textile industry, as well as, of course, the meatpacking industry, which we already talked about. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, women more like Breckinridge, right? No matter how qualified, no matter how educated, no matter how ambitious, had really limited choices. So, I mean, Breckinridge clearly was, you know, relatively speaking, advantaged for instance, the meatpacking workers. But I think, yes, I think that her personal concern for a variety of groups was rooted in her own experiences of discrimination. So along those lines, one of these places where I finally found a smoking gun and I was like, aha, I don't just have to, you know, infer this. I can, you know, really say it a bit more strongly, was when I found a book review that Breckinridge had written about a book called Half a Man that was about race discrimination. And the way that Breckinridge talked about racial discrimination was just so, it mapped so well onto her discussion of her own life in her memoirs, because she talked about how racial discrimination, external obstacles, resulted in or intensified internal doubts, right? That when African Americans encountered racism, that you know, enhanced any doubts that they had about their own worthiness, their own ability, their own deservingness of equality. And that is exactly what comes through in Breckinridge's memoirs about herself, that when she encountered repeated obstacles, she became severely depressed, and she doubted herself and she doubted her own abilities. And so I think then that, yeah, that the challenges that she experienced, while different in type and different in degree from those of some, you know, people, some other people, enabled her to have a sense of identification with them, rather than being just a concerned outsider.
And you talk about early on, which we've touched on, that her story really hasn't been brought to the forefront in the way we would have expected, and that perhaps one of the reasons for that was that she was so collaborative, and that a lot of her work has actually been talked about in the work of other women, and yet she didn't get mentioned. And through the book, we see several really important female relationships that she has. And I was wondering if you could tell us about her relationship with Talbot.
Sure. So, yes, she had a number of very important, significant, life-changing, it's fair to say, relationships with other women. But one of those was her relationship with Marion Talbot, who was the Dean of Women at the University of Chicago, and became first Breckinridge's mentor, and then Breckinridge's champion, and then Breckinridge's partner, both personally and professionally. So Marion Talbot is the one who made it possible for Breckinridge to attend the University of Chicago. By this point, in the 1890s, Breckinridge's family had suffered further financial reverses, first in the Panic of 1873, and then again in the economic downturn of the 1890s. And so Breckinridge was self-supporting, and she couldn't afford tuition at the University of Chicago. And Talbot got her a fellowship, wrenched it away from the university administration after a male fellow had turned it down, and gave her a part-time job. Well, two part-time jobs, actually one part-time job as her assistant in the administrative work of the Dean of Women, and then another as her assistant in the women's residence halls, which of course gave Breckinridge free room and board. And then Talbot constantly agitated for further opportunities for Breckinridge, including her appointment as an instructor initially in the Department of Household Administration, in which she taught that that women's studies course. Breckinridge and Talbot had a relationship that changed in between roughly 1903 and 1911. Talbot was sort of supplanted in for first place, I guess, in Breckinridge's affections by another woman, Edith Abbott, with whom Breckinridge would spend the rest of her life. But Breckinridge never abandoned Talbot. They remained very close friends. They continued to vacation together. Breckinridge, they continued to work together until Talbot's retirement in the 1920s. And Breckinridge visited her every night, no matter what the weather, in Chicago. One of her students commented on this, actually, and she said, Miss Breckinridge went every night to see Miss Talbot. On the other hand, Miss Abbott and Miss Talbot did not get along. I don't know why, which I think is hysterical, because of course, when I read some of the correspondence between Talbot and Abbott, it's quite clear that the reason that they did not get along was because they were vying for Breckinridge's affections. And ultimately Abbott became Breckinridge's longtime life partner.
And you described that as a productive partnership that lasted for more than 40 years. And I hope you'll tell us more about that. But one of the things that struck me was the voluminous nature of the research that you just doggedly and intrepidly uncovered. And there was only a handful of letters and telegrams between the two of them. So for the other chapters, you really had so much primary material. And yet here, this incredibly important, intimate relationship between them, you had very little between them in their own voice. I wonder if you can tell us about that.
Yes. Well, it's one of the ironies, right, that because they were practically inseparable, they didn't have to write to each other very much at all. They didn't actually officially share a residence, actually, until the 1940s. Quite late in their relationship, but they shared offices. They probably shared a room when they were both residents at Hull House, although the records don't reveal that for certain. But they vacationed together for the most part. They traveled together to professional conferences and to, various social reform gatherings, like a gathering in Europe that was about refugees, for example. And so they were hardly ever apart, which means they hardly ever had to write to one another. So it's a bit frustrating that there aren't very many letters, but the letters that they do exchange are so powerful, and they convey so clearly that these women were everything to each other. I'm so sorry. So, they are clearly love letters. I mean, they speak about their mutual devotion. They speak about their need for one another's company and advice and support. And I mean, they're really very powerful letters, but there aren't very many of them. And in fact, I think one of the most important sources on their relationship is actually the condolence letters that Abbott received after Breckinridge's death. And I mean, there's I think, an entire reel of microfilm letters, just of condolence letters, that Edith Abbott received from their mutual friends, their former students, their political allies. And all of them comment that this was like the ideal relationship, that they fulfilled one another's every need, that they complemented one another perfectly, that they cared for each other in illness, and also that their relationship allowed them to achieve far more together than either one of them could have done on her own. And so, so although in some ways the documentation is not as complete as one might wish, there's certainly ample evidence of how important this relationship was personally, professionally, and politically.
And when you are describing Nisba at the end, you say that a current slogan or phrase, "she persisted," really sums her up. And I wonder if you could tell us why that really does sum up the book and her work.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Breckinridge was just incredibly persistent, and she persevered in the face of so many obstacles, obstacles to her own, in her own personal life and in her own professional ambitions, certainly, as I've mentioned, but also obstacles to her political priorities. So she advocated for a ban on child labor for more than 30 years before it was finally included in the Fair Labor Standards Act. And along the way, there were times that it seemed like it had been achieved, and then it was overturned, or it seemed like the amendment was on the verge of being ratified, and then it wasn't. So, so it's a long ongoing struggle, but it's a long ongoing struggle with these setbacks, right? She'd fought so hard for a minimum wage for working women, and then, you know, that was overturned. In other areas, she simply never had any success. So she was a strong advocate of a federal anti-lynching law, and that too, was not adopted in her lifetime. Although, you know, she was pushing for it all along the way. She was a devoted pacifist. She believed that nations should create what she called a world state, and that the advantaged nations should assist disadvantaged nations so that there would not be the kinds of problems that led to discontent and led to rebellion and led to war. And of course, she, you know, opposed both world wars, and yet, as we know, both world wars happened. So, you know, she lost, in the sense of not achieving her ends, she lost a lot. And even when she did achieve things, she often got only a partial win. And then sometimes those gains were rolled back. And yet, she never gave up. And so that's really why then when that hashtag, "she persisted," went viral, that is why I thought that was such a good tagline in our current, what was then our current situation, to describe her. Breckinridge herself used the phrase "passionate patience," which I think also really gets at this really important part of what she was and how she did what she did, was that she was very passionate, and that passion propelled her into this work in the first place and allowed her to carry on this work for decades. And she was also very patient. And so she was willing to just keep at it doggedly for as long as it took.
And you describe her, you say, if she was not the patron saint of lost causes, she was certainly a loyal supporter of unpopular ones.
Yes, exactly. And the anti-lynching legislation would be, of course, one example of that. But many of the other things as well. I mean, so just to give an example that I haven't said so much about, her advocacy on behalf of immigrants was a very unpopular stance, particularly in the years surrounding World War I, and then again in the years surrounding World War II. But, you know, of course, that did not deter her at all. She was absolutely committed to immigrant welfare. She couldn't get federal support, so she started a private agency. During World War II, she did her best to leverage her contacts in the federal government to loosen up refugee policy to allow Jewish refugees in. Obviously, she was unsuccessful, so she definitely was willing to take up unpopular causes and to persist in her support of unpopular causes.
This is such a fascinating book. We've really just hit on the tip of the iceberg. And there's just so much more I could ask you about, but we're running out of time. So I want to ask you if you want to tell us a bit about whatever your current project is.
Sure. So, well, my current project is, of course, converting all of my classes to online and remote delivery in light of the pandemic. But my research project, which I hope to get back to soon, is actually about Marion Talbot. I uncovered so much information about Marion Talbot in the course of my research with Breckinridge because of their close association. And Talbot was such a powerful advocate for equality in women's education at the University of Chicago and elsewhere. That and she also does not have a full-length biography. There's a couple of essays, really good essays about her, but there's no full-length biography. So that is my plan for when I next have the opportunity to travel and go to an archive, is to delve back into the Marion Talbot papers.
And I hope you'll come back and talk to us when that book comes out.
I would love to.
Wonderful. So we've been talking today about Sofan Siba Breckinridge, Champion Women's Activism in Modern America by Anya Jaber. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler. You've been listening to New Book Network. Thank you.
Thank you.